Okay, so today's topic for discussion in terms of our exploring spiritual and religious resistance during the Holocaust is going to focus on two halves of a conversation, and there are two building blocks. They are core components of what comprise an active religious personality in any time in Jewish history, and we'll look at it specifically through the lens of the Holocaust, and those are the components of Torah study, the study of Jewish knowledge, Limud HaTorah, you call it in Hebrew, Limud, and that of Tefillah, of prayer, of conversing with God. And these are two modes of religious expression that are, they are beyond measure in terms of how important they are and also the impact they have on the personality, on a religious personality, on a religious person's life, in terms of their time that they spend learning and the times that a person would spend davening. You call it in Yiddish, you call it davening. And so what I wanted to share today are some primary sources, again, going back to the original sources, because that's what, as historians, that's what you need to do, is to look at primary sources, thinking about Torah study and prayer and the experience of the ghetto, which is what we focused on a little bit last time. I want to continue to focus specifically on the ghetto. So we're going to have two packets, the white packet and the pink packet. The white packet is where we're going to begin focusing on Torah study, and then we'll move to the pink packet. So the white packet begins the conversation with a very fascinating, overarching response in terms of, you talk about religious and spiritual response, that comes from this volume called Hidden in Thunder by Esther Farbstein. This is the first of the two volumes. And this is the full text of an article that appeared in a newspaper. It was originally published in Yiddish. It's actually in the Yad Vashem archives. There's a small page here. If you see the facsimile of what it looked like, it was a 4-page article. I'm on page 1 of the white packet. The book is called Hidden in Thunder. This is the English translation of the original B'Seser Ram. And the article is from this publication called Akol in der Midbar. Midbar is Yiddish for midbar, in the desert. A kol, what's a kol? A voice. A voice in the desert. So here you have a periodical that's published in the ghetto, not for very long, and it was published by Agudas Israel, Agudas Yisrael, which is a major movement, a major Torah Jewry movement in Poland and throughout Europe before the war, and it's extant. It still operates today. The movement of Agudath Israel is very active. It's active in Chicago. It's active around the world and in America. So this publication published this article. It was an anonymously written piece in before Purim of 1942, and it describes Amalek. So who is Amalek? Anybody know who is Amalek? Right? What's that? The bad guys. It's the right. It's the archetype of evil in the Bible. Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Sure.
Is this all part of the Ringelbaum papers?
So this is not actually formally part of the Onyx Shabbos archives, as I'm aware. We're going to get to quite a few of those in a little bit.
Sorry, just wrote it out.
No problem. But actually, Esther Farbstein describes that this, until she published it, she says it was not a well-studied text. There is a similar type of text that was put out in Vilna, in the ghetto, in a response to the understanding that people realize that they're actually out to completely annihilate the Jews. At that time, you know, people were finally coming to that realization. You're talking about 1942. So this is kind of the Amalek. They come at the Jewish people in the biblical narrative out to completely destroy and eradicate us. And now, all of a sudden, the Jews of Warsaw are realizing that the Germans, the Nazis, are not just out to persecute them, they're not just out to kind of corral them, they're actually out to annihilate the Jewish people. So this is the response, this is the initial response of this newspaper that's published in the ghetto in the spring of 1942, and it associates Amalek with the Nazis. And I gave you the whole thing just so you can have it. But what's maybe most interesting, if you go to the second page, what is the response of this newspaper to the horrific things that were happening? It's a religious response. It's a response that says that traditionally in the views of Rabbinic Judaism, Amalek isn't just about trying to annihilate us physically, but it's also a spiritual oppression. And therefore, on the top of page 2 here, on the right column, if Amalek's power stems from doubts and carping, is God among us or not? Then we have to greatly strengthen our faith and trust in God. If Amalek draws its strength from our coldness, asher karcha, and from our negligence and helplessness, the stragglers in your rear, then we must be fervent, strong, and valiant, bear everything, suffer as Jews, and withstand all the trials. If Haman's star rises because we are neglecting the sanctity of our table, so then we have to strengthen ourselves. It's the idea that's being presented here, that the way for Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto to respond to the intense persecution is with a religious revival. At the bottom of the page, the rivers of Jewish blood, and of course by now they've seen so much, so much. You're talking spring of 1942. The seas of Jewish tears, the hundreds of thousands of Jewish kedoshim, meaning holy martyrs, who were tormented and tortured. No man, only God, can avenge these. And He will indeed avenge them. We are sure of it. We have only to wipe out the Amalekism in our own deeds. And then he says, concludes on the next page, we must hasten that day, bring it closer, and we must pray that we will last until that day, etc. So who authored this anonymous work? So we can't say with certainty, but Esther Farbstein suggests, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest, that we can surmise who authored this. If you look on the next page, on page 4, I have for you a document from Yad Vashem. What is this document? This is a form that was filled out in Yad Vashem in the 1950s. If you wanted to document someone who you knew who had been murdered. So this is how, if you go today, and I got this because the archives, the Yad Vashem archives, are accessible to anyone, this archive. If you want to know if you have a relative who you can find out if anybody ever chronicled or figured out where they lived, where they died in the Shoah, so here you have a chronicle, and this is the facsimile of the Xerox, this is the Xerox copy of the submission from 1955 by a woman. Her name is Chaya. Last name is, what is her last name? Hoffman. Chaya Hoffman. She's writing to confirm the death of her uncle. What was her uncle's name? Shem Mishpacha, name of family. What was her uncle's name? Friedman. First name? Alexander. What was his nickname? Zusha. Alexander Zusha Friedman was, what's her relative? Her relative was, this was her uncle. She says, I am her niece. Her father was Yehoshua. His mother's name was Sarah. They had one daughter. Her name was Rachel. What happened to the daughter? Lo Yadua, we don't know. Presumably she was killed in 1942. We don't know exactly how. Where was Alexander Zusha Friedman from? He was from Sochachov. If you see after the word, you see in 1898, that's his birth date. Born in Sochachov, raised in Poland. Where was he in 1939, Poland? What was his job? It's a fascinating document. If you go down to the second to last line, Pakid Beagudas Yisrael Bevarsha. He was an officer of the Aguda in Warsaw. Okay? He's in Warsaw. He's in the ghetto. What happens to him? Hamakom vazman shel misa. Where does he die? Last line of this section. You see where it says? Travniki, 1943. Many of the survivors of the Warsaw Ghetto, especially some of the very prestigious, prominent ones, last time we mentioned the name of Kolonimus Kalman Shapira, was transferred from a shoe factory called the Schultz Shoe Factory. If you read about the ghetto, this is one of the prominent places. They were transferred to a work detail in a labor camp called Travniki, not far from Lublin. So this Rav Alexander Zusa Friedman was born in Sochachov. We can trace it just from this one document, from his niece. Born in Sochachov, moved to Warsaw, was active in the Aguda, of the Aguda of Israel in Warsaw, then is taken to the Tronicki labor camp and is murdered. When is he murdered? Probably in the fall of 1943, probably around November time 1943, when the Germans annihilated the Jews from the Tronicki work camp. So who was this Rav Alexander Zusha Friedman? So we can tell you. This man can tell you. Dr. Hillel Seidman. Dr. Hillel Seidman was a prominent ghetto chronicler. This originally appeared in Hebrew many years ago, and now it was published in English. It's called the Warsaw Ghetto Diaries, published in 1997 by Feldheim. And you have this very prominent scholar and archivist who, after he was liberated, he moved to Israel. He became a very active government official in many different areas, and not just related to the Holocaust. Before the war, he was a well-known activist. Where there is in this Warsaw Ghetto Diary, there are Xerox copies of letters to Dr. Seidman from none other than the Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim died in 1933. Rav Yisrael Meir HaKohen of Radin. He was the leading rabbinic figure in the world, and he actually sends a letter to Dr. Hillel Seidman. If you can help, there's a certain issue that needs addressing, and then he sends a second letter. We have the letters Xerox copied in the book. Hillel Seidman survives the war and goes back and is able, it's a whole long story which we don't have time for today, it's an incredible story of how he's able to put back together the pieces of the diary and retrieve them from various locations in and around Warsaw after the war due to a whole bunch of amazing circumstances. And at the end of his diary, Hillel Seidman, who only died a couple of years ago. When did he die? Late 90s. I don't remember. He died in the late 90s, not too long ago. What's that? Oh, yes. Yes. He has a section in the book called The Warsaw Ghetto Diaries called Personalities I Knew in the Ghetto. Yes, this is the English edition, and some people thought that I wasn't listening last time. If you look, every source in this packet is in English. All right? And I didn't even need Mrs. Frankenthal's assistance. Okay? This is courtesy of Spertus. They lent it because it's not such an easy book to get a hold of. It's called The Warsaw Ghetto Diaries. It's amazing. He himself was a deeply religious man. So he sheds light on many of the religious figures who don't necessarily appear in other accounts of the ghetto. Remember, the ghetto, you had 400,000 people. So not every chronicler is going to give you the same perspective on what's going on. So what I did was, if you look on the next page, this Rav Alexander Zusha Friedman was an extremely active member of the leadership in the ghetto. So just for your edification, I gave you five pages, the five-page entry that Hillel Seidman, Olava Shalom, has on his experience with Rav Alexander Zusha Friedman, the man who we just saw his death certificate from, quote unquote, the death certificate from Yad Vashem. I'm in the white packet on page 5. Pages 5 through 9 give you the biographical sketch of Rav Alexander Zusha Friedman. He was born in 1897, according to this, in August. And what was he involved in? So he moved to Warsaw. He describes on page 6. We're not going to take the time to go through all the details together. But if you look on page 7, he was the Secretary General, and he was very involved in publications. He was an author. So he was very likely the author of this Aguda publication calling on Jews for spiritual resistance in the spring of 1942. And what did he do in the ghetto in addition to writing? If you look on page 8, he was extremely active specifically in the realm of Torah study, of education. So he had a whole established network specifically in the Warsaw ghetto of religious education. On the bottom of page 8 on the left-hand column, he utilized the joint to set up an elaborate network of religious education, officially masquerading as soup kitchens or kindergartens. When the Nazis began seizing and torturing religious teachers, he managed to legalize some of these clandestine institutions under the auspices of the TOZ. And then he became one of its directors, of the directors of the Jewish community of self-help, etc. And actually, Hillel Simon describes that Adam Chernikov, was Adam Chernikov? Right, the head of the Judenrat in the Warsaw Ghetto, reached out on multiple times to Rav Alexander Zusha Friedman to become part of the Judenrat to help him, and he refused. He was busy with his activities, even though it would have offered him a significant salary. And then you describe at the end his end in Tranicki. But what was Rav Alexander Zusha Friedman doing? He was writing for the, he was running the Aguda offices, he was writing for this publication, but he was also educating. Because what is the first and foremost way to express religious resistance that he called for in that letter in terms of maintaining our Jewish identity, our Jewish faith? It's going to be through learning. So he was extremely active in organizing this whole network of schools. Last time, for those who were here, we met Rabbi Shimon Huberband, Hashem Yikom Damo, also another chronicler who authored this volume. This is the English translation, Kiddush Hashem, Jewish Religious and Cultural Life in Poland During the Holocaust. This was part of, someone mentioned, the Onyx Shabbos archives. So Rabbi Huberband was a member of the Onyx Shabbos archives, and there's actually in the front of the book, the head of the archives has a tribute to him after he was killed by the Nazis. I think it was in 42. So Rabbi Huberband is writing about what was going on in the ghetto during this time, and he has an entry, an incredible entry here. I gave it to you on page 10 on different schools of learning, of Torah study that were going on in the ghetto. So he talks about one extreme group called the Harsh Ones. It's very an ascetic group, and then they were involved in some inappropriate behavior. It's called a little bit of controversy. They were eating too much, drinking, whatever. But then he talks about the following story, the following description of Reb Yitzchak David Margulies. Reb Yitzchak David Margulies created an organization, you see it here on page 10, that Huberband is describing, Rabbi Huberband, called the Love of Torah and the Fear of Heaven. So he made, what was his job? He made paper wallets, and he was a philanthropist. He lived on the Panska Street. So he began to recruit members to come and join his study group. And he, on the unbelievable kindness, look on the top of page 187, you're on the second column. Margulies is a simple, warm person who was kind, who was kindness incarnate, had an enormous impact on the young people. He brought together a few artisans and began to study Ein Yaakov with them. Ein Yaakov is the Yiddishized version of how you call the book Ein Yaakov, the Eye of Jacob. It's a collection of the more story components of the Talmud. And he says, he began to teach the class on the synagogue, Sardiner Synagogue on Twarda Street. But the number of students continued to grow, so he established another group in the Nalauki Street section of Warsaw, in the Trakanheim Synagogue. He opened additional study groups. He came with money, advice, other things. Next paragraph. He arranged festive Sabbath meals and Malava Malkas. His students idolized him and loved him dearly. During the current war, next paragraph, he valiantly rebuilt the Love of Torah and Fear of Heaven organization and established it in his apartment on 31 Panska Street. Again, this is not a secondary source. This is a primary source. This is a man who saw it, who lived it with his own eyes. He could testify to this. There he provided his students with food for the spirit and also with food for the stomach. He used to take, for instance, the dough which he used for making paste for his wallets and would cook pink dumplings, which delighted his hungry students. And then in the next paragraph, recently Margulies proposed that every Jew set aside for the poor 10 groschen for every kilogram of white bread he purchased, etc. Unfortunately, during October of 1941, in the typhus epidemic, he died together with his two children. But what was his life's work? It was supporting the study of Torah. It was Torah education, all in all different aspects. And now we come to one more figure who can personify, who can really capture for us the concept of Torah education in the ghetto, and that's on page 11. The great luminary, the great rabbinic genius, the known as Rav Menachem Zemba. Rav Menachem Zemba was the Prager genius. Prague is a city in Czechoslovakia. Praga is a suburb of Warsaw. He came from a small town. I gave you here on page 11 the biography of Rav Menachem Zemba from the Encyclopedia Judaica. Sorry for my little handwritten notes on the side. Rav Menachem Zemba, if you look on the next page, on page 12, maybe we should just close the door so it won't be, please. I don't want them to feel like it's competition. If you look on page 12, you see the picture of Rav Menachem Zemba. This was a man who was an unbelievable genius. As you saw my little handwritten notes on the left-hand column of page 11, Rav Menachem Zemba had in his possession, he had created 10,000 pages of handwritten insights into the Torah. 10,000 pages. Recently, I went with Mrs. Schreiber to do a talk for a group of students, and I took a stack of textbooks and I stacked them up on a desk just so they can envision what is 10,000 pages look like. 10,000 handwritten pages of manuscripts. Two massive works, one on the works of Maimonides, of the Rambam, and the other one on the Jerusalem Talmud. He was a blend of the Polish Hasidic community, but also the genius of the Lima, the world of traditional scholarship. And he was extremely active in the ghetto. So here again, I gave you, on the next pages, on 12, 13, 14, the description, most of the description of Rav Menachem Zemba from Dr. Seidman. He describes how the piety of Rav Menachem Zemba, this is amazing, on 347, how Rav Menachem Zemba, he had to move apartments several times. For Sukkot, 1942, he was in an apartment on the top floor, so he busted through the roof so he could put some schach and sit in the sukkah. And people came through his apartment. But more than that, if you look on page 13, in 1942, Rav Menachem Zemba, together with others we'll talk about in a little bit, had small groups of yeshiva bachrim and a few rabbonim. They soon developed into full-fledged yeshivas. And who was there? Other great rabbinic luminaries, including the Kosher Glover Rav, the Rosh Yeshiva of Chachmei Lublin, and others. They had underground yeshivas. Underground clandestine yeshivas in the bunkers of the Warsaw Ghetto. Unbelievable what he describes. All ghetto Jews recognized the importance of the underground yeshivas. The directors of the top second column of the joint, Gitterman and Guzik, donated money. And Abraham Geffner, director of the Judenrat Supply Department, offered food at cost price. Obviously, he says, Rav Menachem Zemba was the guiding spirit behind all these projects. Jews hid in bunkers and bolt holes and cellars and attics and cold and fear and learned Torah in depth with dedication. He, Rav Menachem Zemba, visited the clandestine yeshivas in Naloki, Noalippi, and Mila streets, testing the yeshiva bachrim and spurring them to greater achievements. In the Mila Street yeshiva, they would learn right through the night. Outside, panic reigned. No one knew what the unnatural lulls signified. Everybody feared what the morrow would bring. But the Gedolei Torah, Rav Menachem Zemba and his Talmidim, ignored this bitter reality, and they were engaged in the study of Torah. Talk about religious resistance. Unbelievable. They had a whole network, an organized network of students who were studying Torah. But not only were their Torah study, as we saw from Rav Zusha Friedman, God should avenge him, for the young children with the network of schools. Not only were there yeshivas for older bachrim, advanced students like Rav Menachem Zemba, but there was a love of Torah. And this is what we'll conclude this section with. If you look on page 15, from Yad Vashem, we have a picture. This is from the Lodz ghetto. A picture of Simchas Torah, a Simchas Torah celebration in the Lodz ghetto. If you can imagine such a thing. Simchas Torah is the time when traditional Jews get together and they celebrate the Torah. It was going on even in the ghetto. I want to share with you one story. This also came up last time. Someone gave some feedback that it's got to be a little more story so we can use in the tours. You know, we're docents, for crying out loud. So this is a story. Also, it appears in two places. It appears in the Ela Ezkara volume that you were looking at around on this personality, Rabbi Yehuda Leib Orlean, on page 16. Rabbi Yehuda Leib Orlean was a great educator, and he was the head of the Beis Yaakov system, the girls' school network. Some are familiar with a woman by the name of Sarah Schneerer. Sarah Schneerer created the Beis Yaakov system. After she died, it was this, if you look on page 17, you see his picture, Rav Yehuda Leib Orlean, who oversaw the Beis Yaakovs, and he was overseeing the Beis Yaakov, even in the ghetto, still continuing to promote education. And now I want to share with you one story that he has on page 19. This is from Hillel Seidman's description. Here it's also in the Ela Eskara, page 19. From Simchas Torah. Unbelievable story. Somebody want to read it? Starting on the paragraph by Simchas Torah 1942.
About 15 men assembled in Rav Menachem Zemba's apartment at 37 Nalmiki Street to pray and conduct the Hakafah.
So we spoke already about Rav Menachem Zemba. You see, his apartment is, it's the headquarters for Jewish life. Okay, sorry.
They held the secret Torah and walked solemnly around the table. All of them were broken men, bereft of family and relatives, their hearts overflowing with despondency. Rav Yehuda Leib was totally heartbroken on discovering that his wife and five children, whom he had personally educated in Torah and piety, had been brutally murdered. The traditional verses of Simchat Torah, usually sung with such gusto, were instead intoned with sadness.
Keep going. Now this is unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
Suddenly, a young 12-year-old boy entered the room and picked up a siddur to pray. This was most unusual. Hardly any children still survived in the ghetto. Generally, they were the first victims of the barbaric Germans. As the congregants stepped heavily around the room, Rav Yehuda Leib suddenly sprang from the circle. He grabbed the young boy and, clasping him to the Sefer Torah in his arms, he began to dance wildly while loudly chanting,
"A younger Yid mit der Heilige Torah."
A young Jew with the Holy Torah. A shudder went through the small congregation at the strange sight. Grown men began to weep quietly. Then they joined in with improvised nigunim and formed a dancing circle around Yehuda Leib and the boy. Rabbi Yehuda Leib danced with unnatural energy, continually roaring out the words.
In Yiddish again, a young man with the Holy Torah.
Despite his own profound personal tragedy, his great love for the Torah, coupled with a great educator's empathy for an unknown Jewish child, found voice in that superhuman dance. That was the final dance on the ultimate Simchat Torah of the last Jews in Warsaw.
Unbelievable. So I'll share with you one more description of Simchas Torah in the ghetto, and that's on page 20, and it comes from this diary. Each diary, each chronicle, boy, it's hard no matter how many times you study it. Each diary has its own, each chronicle has its own perspective, its own kind of flavor. So this diary is much less, it's not academic, it's very personal. It's the diary of Chaim Kaplan called The Scroll of Agony, the Warsaw Ghetto, the Warsaw Diary of Chaim Kaplan. He too was murdered in 1942, but he was actually a principal. He was the head of a Hebrew school and he wrote regularly. So on the one hand, it's not formally like a chronicle from the Oneg Shabbos archives, I believe. I think it was separate. On the other hand, it's written with somebody who knew how to write. So it has a personal flavor, but also the scholarly tone to it. So he describes here on your last page, on page 20, Simchas Torah, 1940, in the Warsaw Ghetto. Amazing. "But we have not shamed our eternal Torah," second paragraph on the left-hand side. Again, this is not secondhand. This is the man describing it himself. This was recovered after the war. "This was not a raucous celebration, but an inner one, a heartfelt joy. And for that reason, it was all the more warm and emotional. Everywhere, holiday celebrations were organized, and every prayer group said the wine blessing. The chassidim were even dancing, as is their pious custom. Someone told me that on the night of the holiday, he met a large group of zealous chassidim on Mila Street, and they sang holiday songs in chorus out in public, followed by a large crowd of curious people and sightseers. Joy and revelry in poverty-stricken Mila Street. When they sang, they reached such a state of ecstasy that they couldn't stop until some heretic approached them shouting, 'Jews, safeguarding your life is a positive biblical commandment. It is a time of danger for us. Stop this.' only then did they become acquired. The strict ban does not become stop the next page. Yesterday, on the night of Simchas Torah, I participated in a Zionist gathering which took place at the Zionist soup kitchen at 13 Zamenhof Street. Established by the Zionists, it serves as a meeting place for refugees from all regions, especially those from Lodz. About 50 people came. It was a warm and pleasant gathering of friends, but by the force of the times through which we are living, there was a change from the normal procedure of proposing festive toasts. So not only were they educating, not only were they learning, so many Jews were even celebrating the Torah, even in absolute brokenness, even in mamash, the deepest depths. Any questions, comments, or observations on piece number one, on Torah study, religious study as a means of resistance? Thank you, okay. No one fell asleep yet. Good. Let's move to the pink packet where we could talk about tefillah, where we could talk about prayer. So let's continue. I want to talk about prayer on a couple of levels, both in terms of the experience of prayer in the ghetto, but also what were they praying in the ghetto. So in terms of the experience of prayer, so if you look here also, same journal from the Scroll of Agony from Chaim Kaplan, Hashem Yikom Domo. This is Rosh Hashanah, October 2nd, 1940. He describes that even on the high holidays, the shul in our closed, the synagogues are closed, silence and desolation. He says, I don't even know if the Judenrat even bothered to ask for permission to use them. Everything, he says in the bottom, is forbidden to us. The wonder is that we are still alive and that we do everything. And this is true of public prayer too. Now, top of the second column, look at this. Amazing. Anybody want to volunteer to read this top paragraph? Who hasn't read yet? Go ahead, please.
Secret minyanim by the hundreds throughout Warsaw organize services and do not skip over even the most difficult hymns in the liturgy.
Amazing. Think about that for a second. It says, secret minyanim, meaning gatherings of Jews to daven, to pray on Rosh Hashanah by the hundreds. They're everywhere, he says. You couldn't get to a shul, but you could find a minyan everywhere. And not only that, keep going.
There is not even a shortage of sermons.
Sermons! You would think, the ghetto, there's sermons even more. And we spoke about this a little bit last time. We don't have time today to talk about the sermons of Rav Klonimus Kalman Shapir, the Holy Eish Kodesh, the Pia Setzner Rebbe. Go ahead.
Everything is in accordance with the ancient customs of Israel. When there is no informer at work, the enemy doesn't know what's going on, and we can assume that no Jewish man, even if he is a Jew born in Poland, would inform on Jews standing before them in prayer.
Unbelievable. And so now he describes exactly what it was like. Go ahead.
They pick some inside room whose windows look out onto the courtyard and pour out their supplications before the God of Israel in whispers. This time there are no cantors and choirs, only whispered prayers. But the prayers are heartfelt. It's possible to weep in secret too, and the gates of tears are not locked.
Amazing. So this is Rosh Hashanah, 1940, in the Warsaw Ghetto. Real davening going on. Real davening. On the next page, I want to take you to the Lodz Ghetto. So this is a huge volume, a thick volume, that I found in this first library called Lodz Ghetto, Inside Community Under Siege. And it's compiled, it's an original collection of documents from chroniclers, and they just organized them. So this that you see on page 3 in the pink packet is a collection, it's a description authored by Rabbi Rachmiel Breiman, who I did find also in the, if you go to the Yad Vashem online archives, you'll find the description of him and the account of him and his death. So this section and the next one too, I gave you the whole section till page 9. It's a whole section that he describes davening in the Lodz Ghetto. It's mamish, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And he describes how many different kinds of minyanim, how many different kinds of shuls they had. So first he describes prayer services were maintained in the ghetto. I'm on page 3. And adapted to its particular conditions and circumstances. Minyans were in existence as soon as the ghetto was established. A whole series of small prayer rooms were added to those that had been in the Balut market area from before the war. There were a few synagogues. Then he goes on to describe what happened after the deportation in 1942, that people, it was very hard to find a place to daven. However, on Yom Kippur, things got back together. A great many minyans had met in the courtyard, and some of these prayers began only with the memorial services for the dead. Go to the next page. You see, here's a picture of someone carrying a Sefer Torah. He says, in the winter of 1942-43, when the work hours went from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m., the minyans became very small in size and number. At night, it was easier to catch a minyan because of the hundreds of Kaddish sayers interested in sending services. There were a lot of minyans on Shabbos. They were even held in many workshops. Next page. Look at the different groups that had minyanim. The Hasidic groups. So that's Alexander, Ger, Koznitz, Chabad, Breslov. Each one of them had their own minyan. Then you had inter-party groups. Then you had groups affiliated with political parties. So you had the Mizrahi, the Aguda, the Chashmonaim. And then you had people in their personal homes, rabbis and yeshiva teachers. Then you had in the homes of mourners and in workshops, many who regularly organize minyans on Shabbos. These minyans have a deplorable appearance, he says. There are a few chairs and tables. Many prayer shawls lie about of those people who have died or been deported for a certain payment. They can be barred by those wishing to catch a quick Kaddish. They tried to provide supplies, but it wasn't much. Next page. Shul bulletins for the minyan. This is how they communicate with each other. Look at the bottom. This is not a secondary source. This is what's happening. Unbelievable. Description. The bottom of page 6. The minyan's door serves as the only religious bulletin board, a means of communication among the congregants. Attention! Anyone needing a proper Kaddish to be recited every day during prayers should contact such and such, address such and such. 2. Taking home holy books or prayer shawls which were contributed and which belong to the people now deceased or deported is strictly forbidden. The fact it is, it's Jewish humor, it's not humorous. The fact that you know that your neighbor was deported last week, do not take his talis. Okay? It's macabre humor for us, it's unbelievable. Because of the strictnesses of the prohibition against eating chametz, dishes can be made kosher for Pesach, free of charge at from 5 o'clock after work until 10 o'clock at night. Today, he says, in honor of Yontif, baths, meaning mikveh, will be available at very low prices at Wolborska Street from 4 p.m. But it's unbelievable. You imagine what's going on. Hell outside reigns, and inside the people are still managing to put together some semblance of davening, of the internal religious life, and the Kaddish, and the Yizkor prayers. It's mamish, it's unbelievable when you think about it. And what were they davening? So with this we'll conclude. I want to share with you two prayers. This prayer is from the Lodz Ghetto. This is from Yad Vashem. The original book was called The Last Ghetto. I was able to get it online. It's not just the Jews, we're davening and we're praying and we're getting together. So we saw Chaim Kaplan in the Warsaw Ghetto, we see this in the Lodz Ghetto. But prayer is not a series of words that are strung together and said. Davening is a conversation with God. And it needs to reflect the reality of life at that time, of what's going on, what it's all about. So there are examples. I'm going to bring you two, and then after I was working on this, I actually found there is a section in the second volume of Esther Farbstein's work on prayer, and she has some of these. I don't remember if she has these, because these I found separately, but she has a whole section on prayers, and prayers that were composed during the Holocaust, prayers that were composed in the ghetto. What are people praying about in the ghetto? Yes, so Chaim Kaplan said they were davening the traditional davening, but they were doing something else too. It reflected the time. So here's one prayer. This is an English translation offered by Yad Vashem from a prayer from inside one of the Lodz ghetto synagogues. May it be your will, you who hears the beseeches of your petitioners, to hearken unto the heartfelt sighs and the pleading that emanates from our hearts each and every day, evening, morning, and afternoon. Our endurance is under strain. We have neither a leader nor a source of support, nor anyone to return to or to rely on, save for you, our Father in heaven. Our Father, merciful Father, you have visited upon us a daily torrent of retribution, famine, sword, fear, and panic. So stop for a second. You could put this together. You take this prayer, and you put it together with a diary from the Lodz Ghetto, and you can understand what it really means. What they're praying about, what they're talking about, we have in primary sources described to us for people who are living at that time, who are experiencing the terrible, unspeakable horrors. And there, how is it being expressed here? It's being expressed here through prayer. Now he's going to paraphrase a section of the Chumash where the Torah describes the time of the curses, where a person will say, in daytime, I wish it were night. And in the nighttime, they'll say, I wish it were day. In the morning we say, if it were only evening. In the evening we say, if it were only morning. No one knows who among your people in Israel, your flock, will survive and who will fall victim to plunder and abuse. We beg of you, our Father in heaven, restore Israel to their precincts, sons to their mother's embrace, and fathers to their sons. Bring peace to the world and remove the evil wind that has come to rest upon your creatures. Unlock our shackles and remove our tattered, befouled clothing. Remember, there's also this, you can see this picture here. And there's so many gruesome pictures in terms of the abject poverty in the ghettos. People, you know, the ability to shower, to maintain personal hygiene, the challenge, of course, how many people have the ability to even have a second pair of clothing? You know, there's the meager provisions that people had were so basic that people were starving in the droves, in the streets. Return to our homes those who have been abducted, deported, and captured. Because we know that already this is not a secret what's happening to those who are being deported. Have mercy upon them and protect them wherever they might be from all evil afflictions, disasters, disease, and all manner of retribution, and extricate us from the woe to relief, from darkness to great light, so that we may serve you with our hearts and souls and keep your holy Sabbath and festivals joyously and happily. Illuminate us in the light of your countenance and make your signs evident so that we may witness plainly as the Lord returns the captivity of his people. Then Jacob will rejoice and Israel will take delight. And may all who seek refuge with you experience neither shame nor disgrace. May God redeem the righteous summarily, promptly, and speedily. And let us say, Amen. Amazing. And one more tefillah, and this is from another archive. This is a publication from Yad Vashem from the 80s. It was entitled To Live with Honor and Die with Honor, Selected Documents from the Warsaw Ghetto Oneg Shabbos Archives. See on the left-hand side is Emmanuel Bringenblum, director of the Ghetto Archives. So in the next page, you'll find in the Oneg Shabbos Archives, they had a copy of a tefillah. It's document ARII 371. Similar, but a little different. A prayer especially composed for the present time. O Lord of the universe, O God, Lord of the world, hearken to our cry, hear our hearts sighing, see our sorrow and pain, and help us in this our great predicament. We, the children of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob, are being driven and chased and afflicted and led like sheep to slaughter. That's an important phrase that comes up in different contexts when we study the Holocaust. May thy will be done, O beloved God, and may it be that we find shelter from all evil, and may thou rescind all persecution intended for us. All those dear to us, our wives and children, our fathers and mothers, our brothers and sisters, and all our kith and kin, the children of Israel who were led away captive, defend them from sorrow and pain, give their bones repose. May thou, O God Almighty, be the protector of all who have been led away, and captive, defend them from all sorrow and pain, give them strength to endure and withstand affliction from the tormentor's hands, give them vigor and persistence, and grant unto them a safe and healthy return to their families. May the babes torn away from the embrace of their mothers return and reappear as of old in the days of the Exodus from Egypt and rejoin their parents. Now, well, look what he says. I pledge here a donation of charity for the hungry and the poor, and may thou grant in return the rescue and safety to ... What does that mean? Here say both the name of the interceded for and of his mother. Think about that. In today, many, many synagogues, many of the shuls where I daven, they make a mishaberach. This is what this is. And they'll say, if you have a name of an ill person, please insert the name. What were they saying in the ghetto? They had a special mishaberach. Please insert the name and give tzedakah for those who had been deported, who had been taken captive, and return him or her in safety to his or her household. O God of compassion and mercy, thou art full of grace and pity, and hearkenest to all who call upon thee out of a pure heart. Take pity on the surviving remnant of thy people of Israel. Call an end to our afflictions and defend us, the tiny surviving handful of Jews, as thou hast defended our forefather Abraham from Nimrod's hand and Jacob from the hand of Esau and Lavan, and thou hast protected Moses from Pharaoh's wrath and rescued David from Goliath the Philistine, or Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah from Nebuchadnezzar, or Daniel from the lions, or Mordechai and Esther from the evil Haman. This is a common theme in rabbinic tradition, in Talmudic tradition, about praying, especially in times of need. And we have this even today when we daven slichos before Rosh Hashanah. We have these special penitential prayers. We always invoke this motif of God who saved so-and-so from so-and-so. He saved this one from that one. So that's the motif that's being introduced here in this tefillah, in this prayer. Just so protect the people of Israel from their enemies and send to them thy righteous Messiah to liberate them from their bitter diaspora. Grant that in our days. Amen. That's the prayer in the Warsaw Ghetto, one of many. So to summarize what we talked about today, it was two halves of this spiritual coin. On the one hand, it's Torah study. So we talked about the devotion to Torah study and education in terms of young people, in terms of Rav Alexander Zusha Friedman, in terms of the education network that he set up. We also mentioned later Rabbi Yehuda Orlean, who was in charge of the Beis Yaakov students for the girls. But then we introduced Rabbi Nachum Zemba, the great rabbinic scholar who was in charge of the Yeshiva Bachram. Assumably these are older boys who are studying collected to Warsaw from other neighboring towns. And then it's not just about the study and the devotion to Torah, even in the cellars and even the sewers and in the bunkers, it's the celebration of Torah, the Simchas Torah experience that we read about and this amazing story of the dance from Simchas Torah. These are Torah experiences, study of Torah experiences from the ghetto. And then you talk about the tefillah experiences. This whole lengthy description in the Lodz ghetto, an incredibly vivid and detailed description of exactly the culture of the davening, the differentiated places where people would daven. And then what they were davening for, how they would say a special mishberach to give charity, whatever they had, for the return of those who are gone. So if you want to talk about spiritual resistance, I think these are two really basic building blocks to think about in terms of study and of prayer. And you could see how it's very vibrant. It's not just an isolated incident here and there. It's part of a big fabric of religious resistance that we spoke about at the beginning that many saw as their way to respond to the current tragedy. So I'm hopeful that you'll take these documents with you and you can look at them at greater length, of course, and then you can reference any of these books. But the idea that we had the opportunity to experience these primary documents to see what it was really like from their perspective, I think will hopefully help us greater understanding for us, but also enable that to be shared with our tours, whatever, you know, in whatever level that's going to be. So this time we focused more, we're still in that section of the tour on the ghetto, and this is kind of a fuller picture of the experience of the ghetto in terms of religious life. Next time I want to talk more about general letters, response, or questions that came about beyond the ghetto in terms of a religious experience, so that we can kind of begin to broaden the picture.